Today, we are opening up a file that I think is going to make a lot of people squirm in their seats a little bit. We're talking about the one-size-fits-all trap.
It's the silent killer of teams.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And we've all been there. You have a boss who is a micromanager, and they micromanage everybody. It doesn't matter if you've been there 10 years or 10 minutes.
They're checking your font size.
Yeah. Oh. Or you have the cool boss, the buddy boss, who is completely hands-off even when the building is, you know, strictly speaking, on fire.
Right.
Exactly. And today we're looking at a stack of research and training materials on situational leadership. And the core premise here is actually pretty confronting. It suggests that if you're consistent, if you treat everyone the same in the name of fairness, you are actually being unfair to about 75% of your team.
It sounds so counterintuitive, doesn't it? I mean, we're taught from day one that consistency is a virtue.
A fair playing field, right. No.
But the source material makes a really compelling and honestly quite harsh argument that in leadership, that kind of consistency is actually just laziness. It's efficient for you, but it's toxic for the team.
Laziness is a strong word to throw at a manager who is probably already feeling pretty overworked.
It is, but think about why we do it, why we default to one style. It's comfortable. It's fast. It feels safe. If I treat everyone the same, I don't have to do the mental gymnastics of shifting gears every 10 minutes.
It's cognitive load management.
Totally. But the research shows this creates a cycle of disengagement that actually creates more work down the line.
Okay, let's break that cycle down because the sources are very specific about the damage this causes. If I'm a helpful hoverer, a micromanager, and I apply that to my high performers, what happens?
Oh, you suffocate them. High performers crave autonomy. I mean, they've earned it. If you're checking their work every hour or asking to be CC'd on every email,
you're not helping.
You're not helping. You're signaling distrust. They feel undervalued. They feel stifled. And eventually, they update their LinkedIn profile. They leave to go somewhere that lets them breathe.
Okay, flip the coin. I'm the hands-off leader. I trust my people, I say, but I apply that to a struggling performer.
Then you're not trusting them. You're abandoning them. They don't know what they don't know. They fail, they panic, and because you aren't there to catch them or guide them, they either get fired or they quit out of shame.
You've set them up to fail.
Completely. And then there's the middle ground, the average performers.
The forgotten middle.
Yeah. Without tailored support, without someone pushing them to the next level or coaching their specific gaps, they just stagnate. They become furniture.
So the mission of this deep dive is to dissect the solution presented in the material, situational leadership. It's about moving from a fixed setting to a fluid one.
Fluid sounds great in theory.
But in practice, it sounds exhausting. It implies I need to be a different person for every meeting.
It is more work up front. Let's be honest about that. It requires paying attention.
But the material gives us a framework to make it actionable so we aren't just guessing. It starts with a diagnostic. Before you can lead someone, you have to understand their readiness.
Yes.
And I want to be clear here. The sources highlight that readiness is not a personality trait. It's not a permanent label tattooed on their forehead.
This is the most critical distinction in the whole stack of notes. We love to label people. Sarah's a rock star. Bob is a slacker.
Right.
But the research defines readiness as a variable state. It changes based on the specific task. And they give us an equation for it, which helps ground the concept.
I love it when management theory gets mathematical. Lay it on me.
It's a simple one. Readiness equals ability plus effort.
Okay, let's unpack the variables. Ability is the can they do it factor.
Right. Skills, knowledge, historical experience.
Mm-hmm.
If I ask you to code a website and you've never written a line of code, your ability is low. It doesn't matter how smart you are.
And effort is the will they do it factor.
But it's deeper than just wanting to do it. The source material breaks effort down into motivation, commitment, and crucially, confidence. You might want to do the job, but if you're terrified of failing, your effort metric takes a hit because you'll hesitate.
So when we mix high and low ability with high and low effort, we get four distinct types of employees. The text calls these the R levels.
The R levels. Hmm. Think of these as the four archetypes you're going to meet in the wild. Every leader has dealt with all four, sometimes in the same day.
Let's walk through them, and I'm going to challenge listeners to picture specific people on their teams as we do this. Let's start at the bottom and work up. R1.
The R1 is the new or stuck employee.
Looking at the grid, this is low ability and low effort. Now, low effort sounds like they're being lazy. Is this the person playing games on their phone under the desk?
Not necessarily, and that's a really dangerous assumption. In the context of R1, low effort usually manifests as insecurity or overwhelm. Visualize someone who is brand new to a complex role. They don't have the skills yet. That's low ability. But because they are drowning in information, their confidence creates a bottleneck. They freeze.
The deer in headlights look. I've seen that.
Exactly.
Right? Yeah.
They might miss deadlines, not because they don't care, but because they don't even know where to start. Or they ask the same basic question 5 times because they're panicked.
And the danger.
The danger is that they fail before they even really begin. Check out because they feel defeated.
So that's R1. Now let's jump to R3. The outline calls this the eager learner.
The R3 is a fascinating creature. This is often the honeymoon phase employee.
On the chart, this is low ability but high effort.
Yes. Think of the fresh graduate or the person who just volunteered for a high-profile project. They're buzzing with energy. They're 110% committed. They're showing up early, staying late.
But
they have no idea what they're doing.
They don't know what they don't know.
Precisely. They are unconsciously incompetent. They think they can handle it because they have the drive.
That sounds dangerous.
It is. The danger for the R3 is the crash. They run 1,000,000 miles an hour in the wrong direction. They make a mess. And when reality hits, when they realize enthusiasm isn't a substitute for skill, they can crash hard and slide right back down to an R1. They lose that spark, and suddenly you have a morale problem.
Okay, so R1 is stuck, R3 is eager. Now we have R2. The capable but cautious?
The R2 is the most frustrating profile for a lot of leaders.
Why is that?
Because on paper, they are perfect.
All right.
This is high ability, but low effort.
Wait, so they know how to do the job. They have the skills.
They have the skills. They've done it before. They are fully capable.
Mm-hmm.
But the low effort here is almost always a confidence issue. This is the person who sends you an email draft and says, can you just read this over before I send it?
Oh, I know that person.
Even though they've written 1,000 emails, they're the validator.
They need a thumbs up on everything.
They are gun shy. Maybe they got burned by a previous boss who yelled at them for a typo. Maybe they're a perfectionist who's paralyzed by the idea of being wrong. But they sit on work. They stall. They overthink.
They're waiting for permission.
And they become a bottleneck. And they drain your time. Because you end up doing the work for them just to get it out the door. It's faster.
Which brings us to the promised land, the R4, the peak performer.
High ability, high effort.
The dream team.
These are the people who come to you with solutions, not problems. They anticipate the next move. They handle complexity without blinking. They're the ones you wish you could clone.
So where is the danger with an R4? They sound perfect.
The danger is you. The danger is that the leader gets in the way. Or worse, the leader ignores them entirely and takes them for granted because they've got this.
Ah.
If you mishandle an R4, they don't just complain, they leave. They have options.
Okay, so we have our 4 characters. R1 is the drowning swimmer. R3, the enthusiastic rookie. R2 is the cautious expert. And R4 is the rock star. But identifying them is only half the battle. The situational part of this whole theory is that you have to morph your style to match them.
This is where the rubber meets the road. You have to shift your S level, your leadership style, to match their R level. And if you mismatch, you create friction.
Let's pair them up. If I identify an R1, that stuck, overwhelmed person, the source says I need to use S1 directing.
S1 is high direction, low support.
Now I have to pause here. Low support sounds harsh. It sounds like I'm being cold or unfeeling.
It's not cold, it's clarifying.
Mm.
Think of it like a GPS. If you are lost in a foreign city, totally turned around, and your GPS says, well, how do you feel about the general direction of north?
I would throw the phone out the window.
You'd be so angry. You wanted to say, turn left in 100 feet.
Give me a command.
Exactly. Binary commands. And R1 is lost. They're drowning in ambiguity. S1 directing is about cutting through the noise. Clear step-by-step instructions. First do A, then do B, then come back to me.
So the low support just means less cheerleading and more instruction.
Correct. You don't need to counsel them on their feelings yet. You need to stop them from drowning. The biggest mistake leaders make with R1s is assuming, oh, they're smart, they'll figure it out.
This sink or swim mentality.
And they usually sink. And then you blame them for not being proactive when really you just failed to give them a map.
Okay, moving to the R3, our eager learners. The source says we need S2 coaching.
S2 is high direction and high support.
This sounds like a lot of work.
It is the most time-intensive style because you are dealing with someone who has high energy, high effort, but low skill. So you still need to provide the structure.
The direction.
Because remember, They don't know what they're doing yet. But because they are motivated, you have to explain the why.
You're teaching, not just telling.
It's a dialogue.
Yeah.
We're going to do it this way, and here's the reason why. You are capitalizing on their enthusiasm to build their skill set. The mistake here is rushing.
Right.
Leaders love the R3's energy, so they skip the teaching part and just hand over the keys.
And then the R3 drives the car into a ditch.
Exactly. You have to harness that energy, not just unleash it. You have to be patient.
Now let's talk about the tricky one, the R2. The capable but cautious employee. They know how to do it, but they won't pull the trigger. We need S3, supporting.
Low direction, high support. This requires a fundamental shift in the leader's behavior. You have to stop giving answers.
That is so hard for people who like to fix things. If I see the problem, I want to solve it.
It's excruciating for a doer boss. The R2 comes to you and asks, "What should I do about this client?" Your instinct is to say, "Call them and offer a discount."
Yep.
But if you do that, you just reinforce their dependency. You prove that they needed you to make the call.
So what do you do instead? How do you handle that interaction?
You turn it back on them. You act as a sounding board. You say, "You've handled this before. You know this client better than I do. What do you think is the right move?"
You're forcing them to realize they have the answer.
You are building the one thing they lack: confidence. You are the cheerleader. The mistake here is slipping back into directing. If you start micromanaging an R2, you confirm their worst fear, that you don't trust them either.
So stop talking, start asking.
Spot on.
Finally, the R4, the peak performer. We use S4, delegating.
Low direction, low support.
The safety net.
This is the ultimate trust signal. You own this, I trust you. Holler if the building catches fire, but otherwise, I'm out of your hair.
I imagine the hardest part here is letting go of control.
Oh, absolutely. Especially if the leader is an expert in that area. It's hard to watch someone else do it, maybe even differently than you would. But the mistake here is hovering.
The fake delegation.
Right. If you say, "I trust you," but then ask for a daily update, or you're constantly dropping by their desk just to check in, you're lying. You're an S1 leader in an S4 disguise.
And the R4 sees right through it.
And they resent it. They interpret it as you waiting for them to mess up.
So the framework is logical. Match the style to the readiness. But the source material throws a wrench in the gears here. It says the hardest part isn't the matching, it's the diagnostics.
Right. You don't have a dashboard that says skill level 40%. Mm. You have to figure it out. And the text breaks this down into two buckets that you need to investigate: the skill gap versus the will gap.
This is the can they versus won't they question.
And getting this wrong is disastrous. If you treat a will problem like a skill problem, if you try to train someone who just doesn't care, you are wasting your breath.
You're teaching them how to fish when they hate seafood.
Perfect analogy.
So let's role play the diagnostic. How do I spot a skill gap?
Signs of a skill gap are usually innocent. The person wants to succeed, they are trying, but the output is wrong. They are frustrated. They look confused.
The source suggests a golden question here. Walk me through it.
It's such a powerful tool. Don't ask, "Do you understand?"
Mm-hmm.
Because they will just say yes to avoid looking stupid. Everyone says yes.
Yeah.
Instead, ask, "Walk me through how you would approach this task." And if they stumble or if they miss a step,
then you know it's a skill gap. You have your answer. The solution is training. You teach them. Simple.
You can fill a knowledge bucket. But then there's the will gap.
The darker side of the moon.
Yeah.
They have the ability. You've seen them do it. They have the track record, but they aren't doing it.
The signs here are different. Reluctance, excuses,
yeah.
Low energy,
mm-hmm.
Or maybe they're just doing the bare minimum.
The source warns us here. Low effort isn't always laziness. I think that's important to flag because we tend to villainize these people.
It's crucial. A will gap can be caused by fear. It could be burnout. It can be a personal issue at home. Or it can be that they just don't see the value in the work.
They think the task is stupid.
Right. So asking, "Walk me through the technical steps," won't work here. They know the steps. They could write the manual on the steps.
So you have to ask.
What? You have to ask, "How are you feeling about this?" Or, "What is getting in your way?" You have to get to the root of the motivation blocker. And this is, key training will not fix this.
You can't teach someone to care.
You have to address the mindset.
This leads us to the section of the material that I found the most provocative, the average performer dilemma.
This is the elephant in the room.
We all have them. The employees who do enough to stay employed. They aren't on a PIP, but they aren't pushing the needle. They are just coasting.
The quiet quitting crowd, perhaps? Or just people who have settled into a comfortable groove.
The source poses a really tough decision tree for leaders here. When you have an average performer, you have to decide. Is this a ceiling on their capacity, or is it a refusal to engage?
If it's a capacity issue, a skill gap that simply can't be closed, you have to recognize that limits exist. Not everyone can be an astronaut.
Right.
Not everyone can be a VP. Maybe they are in the wrong role, or maybe this is just their ceiling, and you accept that. But if it's a will gap?
If they have the potential but refuse to use it.
That is a mindset issue. And the source is blunt about this. You can coach mindset. You can set expectations. You can hold them accountable. You can try to inspire them, but you cannot care more about their career than they do.
That's a heavy realization for a manager. We want to be the hero. We want to fix everyone.
We do. But situational leadership isn't just about adapting to help people grow. It's also about clarity.
Yeah.
If you are pouring S3 support into someone, giving them encouragement, listening, removing obstacles, and they still refuse to engage.
Then you have to ask a hard question.
Is this a leadership failure or a fit failure? Sometimes the situation is that they shouldn't be on the team. And realizing that is part of leadership too.
You can't lead someone who refuses to follow.
Exactly.
So we've covered a lot of ground, but I want to circle back to one specific insight from the source material that really blew my mind. It's the idea that readiness is task specific.
This is the one thing I hope listeners take away. If you forget everything else, remember this.
You cannot label a person as an R4.
No. You can't say Jennifer's my peak performer and leave it at that. Jennifer might be an R4 when it comes to financial analysis. She's a wizard. You use S4 delegating.
You leave her alone. But
if you ask Jennifer to lead a client presentation, something she has never done, she is not an R4 anymore. In that moment, for that specific task, she is an R1. She is a beginner.
And if I treat her like an R4 because she's smart, and I just say, go get him, Jen, you're a rock star.
She will crash and burn. And she will resent you for it. You set her up to fail. You assumed because she was good at math, she'd be good at public speaking.
So I have to switch from get out of her way to give her step-by-step instructions just because the task changed.
Yes. A leader must reset their style every single time the task changes. It requires hyper-awareness.
Yeah.
You have to constantly be calibrating.
That effectively kills the ego of the leader, doesn't it? It's not about my style.
Not.
It's not about I'm a tough boss or I'm a servant leader.
It's not about you at all. It's about them. It's about what they need in that specific moment to succeed. If you are being a tough boss when they need a coach, you're failing. If you're being a buddy when they need direction, you're failing.
That's service. Leadership as a service.
That's a great way to put it. You are serving the needs of the employee to get the result.
So here's our final thought for you to chew on today. The source material poses a challenge regarding those middle performers, the ones coasting on the will gap.
Right.
We talked about how you can't want it more than they do. The question the source leaves us with is this. How long is too long? How much time do you spend trying to coach motivation before you realize you are just enabling mediocrity?
That's the uncomfortable calculus of leadership. We want to save everyone. But sometimes the best thing you can do for the team and even for that individual is to stop accepting average as the standard.
If you tolerate the gap forever,
you lower the bar for everyone else.
Heavy stuff, but necessary. So here is your mission for today. Don't try to overhaul your whole management style overnight. Just pick one person.
Just one.
Identify one person on your team who is struggling with a specific task. And ask yourself the diagnostic question, is this a skill gap or is this a will gap?
And once you answer that, adjust your channel.
Right.
If they are drowning, give them direction. If they're scared, give them support. Stop broadcasting on the channel you like and tune in to the one they need.
You might be surprised how quickly the static clears up. Thanks for diving in with us.
See you next time.